House committee come to order. Today is Thursday, March 19th, 2015. We're going to go out of order a bit. I have a couple of representatives that have other business they need to attend to. So I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2936 and call Representative Wilson Stark. And you're going to bring your chief up with you?
Yes,
sir.
Sure.
We'd love to.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2936 comes to us from the Committee on Health Care. It defines sobering facility and extends criminal and civil immunity to sobering facilities for actions taken in good faith with probable cause and without malice. The bill protects records disclosure without a person utilizing the facility's consent. It allows police to take an intoxicated person to a sobering facility, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. We have dash four amendments before the committee this afternoon, which update the definition to sobering facility.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, Carl Wilson, House District 3, Grants Pass. Thank you for hearing our bill. We're excited about it, and many people in Grants Pass are really thrilled with this opportunity for us all today. I'm here to testify on House Bill 2936, a bill which creates a framework for establishing sobering facilities. I'm sponsoring this bill on behalf of the Grants Pass Sobering Center Board, a group of dedicated people who have identified a dire need in our community for a safe, supervised environment for acutely intoxicated persons to sleep it off. This is a huge problem in an underfunded community. In Josephine and other Oregon counties, jail beds are scarce, and they are getting more scarce, and there is no room to spare. Law enforcement officials need a place to take acutely intoxicated or incapacitated persons who may pose a danger to themselves or others, but they have not been charged with a crime. And in your packet, you'll find letters of support from Oregon Prevention, Education and Recovery Association, Josephine County Sheriff Dave Daniel, Options for Southern Oregon Executive Director Carla McCafferty, Josephine County District Attorney Ryan Mulkins, Rita Sullivan, who is Director of OnTrack, Grants Pass Mayor Darren Fowler, Katie King of the American College of Emergency Physicians, and Southern Oregon Alcohol Drug Abuse Treatment, or ADAPT, Program Director Bob Morgan. The last page in the packet is a photo that is depicting a typical sobering center amenities. In addition to mental health and law enforcement support, the healthcare community in general has been very supportive of this project from its very earliest stages. Asante, All Care CCO, and Primary Care CCO have provided funding for the project and have pledged long-term support, and that's important, long-term support for this sobering center in Grants Pass. Information coming from other areas such as Yukon Area Native Health Corporation in Bethel, Alaska, demonstrates conclusively that its sobering center has significantly eased emergency room caseloads of intoxicated persons. Unfortunately, in our community, that is the destination of first choice, and for a reason. Reportedly, the nearby correctional center in Alaska also has experienced a reduction in the number of protective custody cases involving intoxicated persons. And I do urge your support of House Bill 2936 to help Oregon communities provide compassionate support, introduce treatment options, and prevent future victimization. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative, House District 4. Chair Barker, members of the committee, I appreciate you hearing this today, this testimony. I actually am here on behalf of my community who reached out to us, and I heard about this project far before I ever even decided to run for office. I'm a local outreach pastor in my community, and so I see the happenings of everyday citizens there. I also had an opportunity to witness the unfortunate occurrences of what normally happens in the situations we're talking about. You know, things like this newspaper came out this week talking about the lack of funding there, the problem with the lack of jail beds, and the professional vagrancy issues that we're having in Grants Pass. This is a weekly news that we're seeing. I saw it in a much scarier fashion in that my wife used, currently she's a professional counselor, She used to do the mental health evaluations at the hospital for people who were a danger to self and others. And as our jail capacity went down, she got to the point where they would take these individuals who were a danger to self or others because they were acutely intoxicated. They would take them to the hospital, tie up very expensive beds and all kinds of time, and they would call in the mental health professionals to do the evaluation on them. But the professional, my wife, would show up and not be able to do the evaluation for hours because you can't do an accurate mental health evaluation while someone is acutely intoxicated. So they sit around for hours or they wait to come in. And this is an ongoing problem, and it's a very expensive problem. This is the sobering center concept that Josephine County and the citizens have come together to propose would add a basically one step in between so that once that person is no longer acutely intoxicated, then, if they are still a danger to self or others, they can get the mental health evaluation at that point, as opposed to tying up these ER rooms, which is, again, like I said, very costly. So nonprofit board worked together to come up with a solution, but they can't do it without this bill. And so we understand there's a need to put There's a need to have the definition put into the ORS where we can find treatment facilities and other tools in the toolbox for law enforcement and social services and health providers to consider, such as a sobering center. Now, we've worked with a variety of people out there who have had some concerns. You guys, I believe most of you have been made aware of some of the concerns, and you'll probably hear about some of those today. The Dash 4 amendments before you, in my opinion, adequately address those concerns. The Dash 4 does several things. One, it establishes, it more clearly defines what a sobering facility is. We worked with AMH, and they helped us come up with the proper wording that we needed for that, including that this would be a standalone facility, whereas the current existing sobering centers are connected to detox or treatment facilities. And then they also wanted us to make sure we had the wording in there of acutely intoxicated and a safe, clean, supervised environment. Those were very key to this. One other thing that we wanted to make sure is that there was some sort of oversight that we could connect and create a partnership with treatment facilities, with those who are already regulated and approved by Oregon Health Authority, that it's kind of a big brother mentorship program where they can keep an eye on things and help direct that program and make sure that there are things in order there and that this is not just kind of a wild thing on its own. It's definitely going to be connected to those others. So that's where we're at. I really want you guys to hear from people who are on the ground floor. We have to our left here is Chief of Police Bill Landis, and to my right, actually Rick Jones from Choices Counseling Center in Grants Pass, who is one of the founders of the More Sobering Center unit in Medford. I don't know who's up first.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you for having me or listening to me. I work for a public safety department of which police, fire, and 911 communications are under one roof, so I wear many hats besides the fact...
You need to just say your name for the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. I am Bill Landis. I am the public safety director in Grants Pass.
Thank you.
I wear many hats. My department has police, fire, and 911 communications under the same roof. And so as I speak to you today, it's not just as a police officer, but it's also from fire rescue where EMS is provided and our 911 communicators. 25 years ago, I started my career, and we had the luxury, I guess now I could say, of having something referred to as Rogue Recovery, which was a detox slash treatment provider back in the day. We also had another service provided by the mission, which was called the Ray Allen Center. As a young officer, I learned that when people were severely intoxicated or impaired, I had the opportunity to take those folks to one of those locations without having to wait for them to commit a crime like trespass or disorderly conduct and introduce them into the criminal justice system, which was too costly and didn't result in prosecutions and just fouled the system. It was a great thing. Unfortunately, those are private funded, and one day in Josephine County, those went away. Several years ago, I was actually speaking on a radio station when people were saying, hey, there's a lot of these folks that are just all over now. What are we doing? And I was talking about things that had changed, bath salts, methamphetamine psychosis, acute alcohol issues, and so on and so forth. It wasn't the same thing it was 25 years ago. And I talked about the fact that we used to have one of those places. Well, that actually started a grassroots campaign, I guess you could say, of the community kind of getting together. treatment providers such as Rick Jones, mental health providers. Our local DA had an advisory capacity. One of our judges, treatment, mental health, everybody basically came together and said, hey, we need to try to solve this problem and do this. Funding was certainly a challenge. I can tell you today, with as Representative Wilson said, we have partnered with others who financially see the benefit. We have raised over $250,000 to make the effort. We have not seen any resistance anywhere in the community until late, as far as the trial lawyers, I understand, everyone realizing what the benefit would be. As Representative Stark stated that, you know, jails are going away in Josephine County, you know, even if I had 300 jail beds, I guess one thing I would say is I don't want to take people and give them some sort of criminal history to get them into a system that is not where they're needed. They need the opportunity to transition into treatment, and all the treatment providers would tell you, much like Representative Stark said, until they're sober, we don't have an opportunity really to get them treatment or assess them as far as mental health, and a lot of those are intertwined today. So I would just ask you to support House Bill 2936, help a community like mine go back to solving those problems without making it something that has to go through the criminal justice process so that we can give people an opportunity to get clean and sober. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, committee. My name is Rick Jones. I'm the director of Choices Counseling Center in Grants Pass. We've existed for a little over 20 years in Grants Pass. I'm actually in my 40th year in Oregon as a treatment provider. I've worked in Klamath Falls, Medford, and Grants Pass my entire career. So it was with pleasure that a couple of years ago, Chief Landis called me and said, you know, we're struggling with some stuff. Can you come talk to us? And he didn't even know at the time, but I actually did start a sobering unit in 1992 for Jackson County, which is now the Moore Center, operated by the Rogue Valley ARC. And I just found it a solution for what we were actually working with. I work for a company that is very involved in the medical arena. I've worked for the medical arena. I've worked in criminal justice. I've worked in social model detox programs. And my assessment over the years has been that the sobering unit that I worked in 1992 was one of the better ways to deal with public inebriates who needed a place to be safe for a period of time before they were actually addressed by any other facilities. Day in and day out in Josephine County, we're struggling with trying to figure that out with the mental health component where, as Representative Stark mentioned, it's like, how do you tell if they need mental health services when they're still drunk? And Chief Landis mentioned that we're dealing with a whole other culture of drugs with the bath salts and some of the designer drugs that are actually long-term and make people a little psychotic at first, and you really have to get them safe and watch them for sometimes a day or two before you can even figure out what's going on with them. So this bill, 2936, really helps us move in a direction to put that together in Josephine County. I represent the drug court in Josephine County. We've had almost 500 graduates via coerced treatment. So I'm a firm believer in working with criminal justice and working with the medical arena and the mental health arena and providing this process. I've trained many techs and many counselors on, you know, how to work with law enforcement and how to work with people who are incapacitated or violent. And there's just a real humane, progressive way of dealing with this rather than having someone get a criminal record or be in the hospital where they're chewing up medical dollars that shouldn't be used for that purpose.
Thank you, Chair Barker. I do want to add, you know, some of the questions that came up about this that in the letters that you may have received as far as, you know, liability and so forth, we did forward those on to legal counsel, and we actually have legal counsel here, and if you want to hear from them, but they assured us that this was a limited liability and not a blanket liability. And then we also have in the back of the room, I believe we have staff from Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. If you have questions for them, like I said, we're not going at this alone. We've been working with these groups to make sure we have all of our I's dotted and T's crossed. So, okay, I'll stop there.
One question I'd have in the letter, they said, how do you know, or that there might be the possibility of that somebody that working in the sobering center could be a sex offender, or could, you know, who's going to be in charge of seeing to it that the people who might be in charge of that, the people working there would be on the up and up, so you don't have somebody you don't want in there that nobody would want in there.
Right.
Thank you for the question, Chair Barker. I am part of that 501c3 board that was formed in Grants Pass, and so part of that would be proper screening and training to ensure that. Our board actually existed to consist of law enforcement, prevention, mental health, and that is actually how our board is made up, to make sure that we have proper training, proper consideration, the law enforcement screening piece, to make sure we have people that are there that, you know, aren't going to create more problems in there. So that's kind of how we address that.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Krieger.
Either one of the reps, your county is in difficult financial situation like mine is, and Curry County is even worse than Josephine. Our jail will probably close. I don't know if we have any type of opportunity, you know, in Gold Beach or Brookings, but from Brookings to Coquille Jail is 2 hours one way. So that deputy, or whoever who's got, you know, the police officer, most of his shift would be taken up just transporting somebody, let alone not having someone help cover or be backup in our rural communities. So I think this type of facility, as our timber-dependent counties start to struggle more, and there's going to be several more come on the line in the next few years, Coos County's not far behind. This might be a way to develop a system that would, I think, help our rural communities. In our some of the information received from Kearney, and is it Kearney and Francis? Unregulated, no minimum, private, taking them into custody against their will, secret locations, indefinite periods, would reintroduce the drunk tank. I take offense, and I hope he's here, that anyone that writes that kind of an inflammatory, inaccurate letter and thinks that the Judiciary Committee is going to swallow that much of crap.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Barker.
Thank you, panel.
Chair Barker. Yeah, Chair Barker to Representative Krieger. Thank you very much. I think that you understand poignantly, as we do, what can happen to a community when it loses so much that is part of its heritage and part of its income over time. There was a time when I woke up about 2 years ago to see what had happened to my own city and that I didn't recognize it any longer. And I have been in that city since 5 years old, 1957. I realized, obviously, that most of my friends that I grew up with, their parents had been in the timber industry. And, of course, when we lost that, we lost so much of who we are and what we can do. And so I began a conversation on my radio show several years ago about the problem that I called professional vagrancy. And there are homeless, and then there are the professional vagrants. And this has become just a huge problem for us. And there just has to be a better way to care for them than we've had to resort to. And I think this is really a fantastic answer for an underfunded county. It's very easy for the those who choose to engage in the vagrant lifestyle. It's very easy to treat them in a very inhumane way, and that has never been our desire with the kind of community that we are. And we do believe that this is really the greatest and best answer for the humane treatment of the people that are so afflicted, as many of these are.
Thank you very much. Next, I'll call Kyler and Jeff Howes. And while we're changing panels, I'd like to just recognize somebody in the back of the room. Bill Taylor's here today, and Bill was our legal counsel, not just ours, but in the building for over a quarter century. And he has took a leave. He's up getting some medical treatment, but he's down visiting today, and he looks great. You stand up, Bill. Thank you. And we're really glad to see you back. No. Great to see you. Thank you.
I feel better down here than up there.
Good. You look better. Okay, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager here in support of House Bill 2936. I think I know Representative Greenlick may recall we did a sobering pilot program in Eugene with $50,000 worth of money from the legislature last session, and we did an interim report back to the Committee on Health Care as to our findings. And there were a couple things that we pointed out during that report back that we had thought were important in looking at the existing sobering center in Lane County called Buckley House. It's in downtown Eugene.
I still wear a T-shirt from Buckley.
Yes, right. I recall that. We Representative Krieger used to pay for Buckley House services entirely out of our general fund when we had ONC dollars in Lane County. Those dollars are almost completely eliminated now. So we've been really putting those dollars together that are necessary to run this facility, about $300,000 a year through a variety of sources, some Community Corrections Act funding, some contributions from the local hospital, some one-time from the CCO. The cities of Eugene and Springfield and Lane County all contribute to make this thing work. With the additional money from the legislature, there was a couple important things. One is that they actually had a person who they then could employ who would be at the sobering center pretty much 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning when the folks who had normally gotten up at that time and made their way to the exit were actually greeted with a warm handshake and an offer of assistance and sort of begin your day with, is today the day we can move you over to the other side of the facility and get you into that detox treatment. And that was a point we made in our report back, was that sobering centers aren't treatment. They are simply a place to keep people safe, but having that supported wraparound service is key to getting the person over into treatment, which is significantly Medicaid supported. And I think the other thing that we said to the committee was having a definition for sobering facility in statute is important. Perhaps it becomes the first step in trying to find some additional funding for these kinds of services that I'm in complete agreement. We need to figure out how to have them in more communities because they are a very important policing tool. We were able, through that pilot, we worked closely with the chief of police in Eugene. He had identified 24 what he called high utilizers of service, people that they pick up time and time again. In fact, his 24 people in calendar year 2013, they had 485 police contacts with. Of his 24 high utilizers, 22 of the people who were in Buckley House lined up with that list. And so you can see how important it would be for even one or two people to make their way over into the treatment side and to get sober in a longer term fashion. Is incredibly important for taking some of the pressure off of local police agencies. And we think that it's part of what we've begun calling a criminal justice behavioral health partnership that I think is really sorely needed in Oregon. The only thing that I would offer in conclusion is that the one thing that we were able to do, because in the sobering center, those people were not covered under 42 CFR, which is that federal statute for people who are in addictions and mental health, that privacy standard. The Buckley House was actually able to share those names then with the policing agency to make that connection about who was who. And additionally, with the emergency department of the hospital. So they were able to have a conversation where they could say, at least we recognize certain names. And I think that that's the only part of the bill I sort of have a question about, is whether that standard for privacy should be in the bill. And I think, at least talking to folks beforehand, there may be some additional work that can be done in that particular regard. I may be wrong, but I think it's an issue that's worth exploring a little bit more for the purposes of the policing perspective. Thank you.
Mr. House. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Jeff House. I'm a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. I'm here testifying on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association in support of House Bill 2936. In short, this is a good idea. This fills a needed gap between jail, hospitalization or leaving someone on the street in a potentially dangerous condition and in a dangerous situation. I spoke at length yesterday with Ryan Mulkins, the new district attorney of Josephine County, and he highlighted for me just exactly what that need was, that to tie up a law enforcement officer in a small community, maybe even requiring an intoxicated person requires a trip to a hospital as opposed to a sobering facility, tying up that law enforcement officer for hours on end, transporting to a hospital, to an emergency room, and then waiting while that intoxicated person is seen by a medical professional, when that law enforcement officer could be out working on the streets, keeping the public safe. Mr. Mulkins, District Attorney Mulkins in Josephine County, impressed upon me the great need for such services, not only in Josephine County, but to him specifically in Josephine County, but elsewhere in our state. I also spoke with members of the Portland Police Bureau Behavioral Health Unit, and I posed a question to them. What would be your preferred course of action if you came across a acutely intoxicated person, a hospital, jail, or a sobering facility like the one we have in downtown Portland, Hooper Detox? And without missing a beat, obviously the answer was the sobering facility. There's no reason to involve the criminal justice system. There's no reason to involve Legacy Emmanuel or Portland Adventist or another large healthcare facility, but rather the sobering facility is the way to go. Now, I had conversations with others who had some concerns about the bill in its original form, and it's my opinion that the Dash 4 amendment should alleviate those concerns. The language that defines sobering facility, I think, is instructive to us all. Offers to individuals who are acutely intoxicated a safe, clean, and supervised environment until the individuals are no longer acutely intoxicated. The fact that it would, under the Dash 4 amendment, be associated with an addiction treatment program or provider supervised by the Oregon Health Authority, I hope would alleviate any of the concerns that may have been raised. That's all I have. I know I'm brief today, and I'm happy to answer any questions for you, but I wanted to come up here and let you know that the Oregon District Attorneys Association supports this this bill. Thank you.
In Lane County, you said it was the pilot project. Do you know how many intoxicated persons have visited or been brought into that facility?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, I can get that information for you. I don't have it off the top of my head.
I'd like to know that. And then also, did you receive complaints from any of those people of the way that they were treated? And have a little bit more of an idea of the process. You know, if you're taking them to a jail, you kind of know the process of checking them. How often are they checked? What type of, do they have beds for them? And how often are they checked in those beds to make sure they're okay? Can you provide some of that for us?
Absolutely. Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, might be the easiest thing is I can get the director of that facility to give you a call or answer those questions. I will say that when we did do the presentation to healthcare, we actually showed a video of one of the people who'd come through the program. And, I mean, she just had an incredible story of appreciation for the folks at that facility who really do sort of need to be part law enforcement, part angel, as far as I can tell, in terms of trying to bring people back to, good sense of self-respect.
Yeah. I just would say, when I first started the law enforcement business, it was a public intoxication was still a crime, and it was a gigantic waste of everybody's time the way that worked. And as far as the privacy part of it, I think part of that is to make that less of a criminal in nature, and because I've taken virtually all standards of living, people from all different stratus of the citizenship to detox in Portland over my years. So, and it's kind of a privacy issue. You don't want to, we're not trying to take them there and humiliate them and so on. So that's why we're trying to protect that privacy.
Yes.
And also, I would just say that the Fourth Amendment, the Dash 4 Amendment, as Mr. House said, really alleviates, I think, I hope, some of the concerns that the other people had. And they, when they sent the letters, they didn't have this before them to take a look at that. So, okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll call Bill Francis, Peter Carini, and Arthur Towers, please. Go in any order you'd like, but please remember to identify yourself for the record. Thank you.
Sir,
go ahead.
My name is Pete Carini. I'm the person that just was attacked a few seconds ago. My intent here is not to persuade you to do one thing or the other. My intent is to make you aware that this legislation wasn't well conceived. There's a lot of problems with it. There's a lot of problems with it because it's overexpansive, and it creates a situation where you're going to have private entities in whatever form, whether they're nonprofit or private, whether they have board members who are police officers or treatment people who or not, you're going to have private entities that are going to have control over citizens. They're going to have total control and they're going to have immunity. I mean, I haven't read the Dash 4. I didn't have Dash 4 when I wrote up my email, but I don't know if there's any change to the term malice. I think the standard that's being used to have a claim against somebody is malice. Malice is a very, very high standard. I mean, I don't know how you would prove malice if you were an operator of this facility unless you could establish that you directed one of your employees to deliberately beat somebody for the purposes of causing an injury and for no other reason. Thank you. So there's a virtual grant of immunity. There's no oversight from any legislative body. There's no political oversight. There's no sheriff involved. There's no someone elected involved. There's no press or Fourth Estate that can be involved in oversight this. Nobody can get access to it. There's no rules and regulations from anybody who has any experience in this, the Oregon Health Authority. And I would suggest to you, if this was a need, if there was an actual need for a treatment type component as opposed to a holding facility jail, then the Department of Health would have recognized that and addressed that in their rules and regulations. This facility is not going to provide treatment at all. It is purely a holding facility. We call those places jails. An acutely intoxicated person should not be held in a facility where a person is not trained to deal with an acutely intoxicated individual. It's dangerous. That's why the Department of Health says those people need to go to a treatment facility where the people are trained to be able to deal with those people, and if the treatment facility deems them to be acutely intoxicated, that they are to take those people in. There will be no one at these holding facilities that will be able to determine if a person is acutely intoxicated or under the influence or normal for that point. I want to, another reason I'm here is we have the Moore Center sobering unit in Jackson County. It is a jail. There is no treatment there. People are put onto a floor. Their families don't know where they are. They can't get a phone call. They can't get out. I have clients that have been taken there because they were mouthing to police officers. This is I'm not making this stuff up. The things that I have in my letter are things that I've personally experienced with clients. I've had clients in there who were taken in there for being under the influence of alcohol. They blow in the machine, there's zeros. The police officer says they're under the influence of drugs. They're kept there for 12 hours. Their urine tests come back with nothing in them. They have no substance in them whatsoever, and the treatment facility person is not doing any assessment because they're not qualified to. So with that, I'll keep with my statement.
Please go ahead.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, my name is Bill Francis. I'm an attorney. I practice with Mr. Carini in Jackson County. And I will stand by his comments, and I'll make a few comments of my own. As I set forth in my letter, However well-intentioned this legislation is, and whatever public health need seems to be manifest by the shortage of funds for jails, we're talking about something separate and apart from the need to house people who somehow should be housed for whatever reason. And in making this attempt, this bill, as it's drafted, contains provisions that are simply going to deprive citizens, if not strip them outright, of essential and fundamental constitutional and statutory rights while you're creating a brand new class of treatment facility. But, as my colleague said, this is not a treatment facility because no one who staffs such a facility is competent, qualified, trained, or in any way deemed competent to provide treatment. These are holding facilities only. And, in fact, you can go through the training manuals at the existing so-called sobering facility in Medford, and there would be instructions to everybody on staff. We are a holding facility only. If someone asks for so much as a Band-Aid, you are not to provide it. You are to refer these people to properly trained, licensed, supervised, authorized medical personnel. Now, we can say that we need to take people off the street and keep them safe, but I would submit to you that keeping a person safe who is acutely intoxicated, and I've yet to hear a satisfactory definition about what acute intoxication would be, and I can address that in just a moment, but to have a person put into essentially a 6x9 concrete room with a steel door, with a slide space, and no window, an exposed toilet, and put that person in a room with as many as 5 or 6 other persons who themselves, I guess, are supposed to be acutely intoxicated, suggests to me that they're not being supervised, they're not being kept safe, they're not being sheltered, they're not being protected when you've got that many people in that small a space.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to object to this right now. I mean, this individual just says 6x4 cell with no windows, and we haven't heard any testimony to that effect yet. I mean, from anybody.
If I could speak to that.
We do have the pictures, and that's not the description I see in the picture.
If I could speak to that, the spaces in which someone would commonly be held in the Jackson County sobering unit, of which I'm aware, is 6x9 feet. They're with an unenclosed toilet and no beds, no furniture. Persons who are brought there are given a thin plastic mat and may or may not be given a blanket. The door is locked. They're not allowed to contact anyone on the outside world. No one in the outside world is permitted to contact them. And the problem with this bill, in a number of ways, and one of the things that I find problematic, is that there would be no disclosure of who is being held, how long they're being held, when they're being released. And then there's also the problem of immunity, giving immunity to a private organization or a business that's operating this new class of private holding facility. Now, in 1971, the Legislative Assembly dealt with problems of public drunkenness and determined that it would be best in the future, in years following, to treat this as a public health issue and not as a criminal matter. And what came out of that was a sense that people who are acutely intoxicated, people who do need help from the public health sector, would be taken to an appropriate facility. Now, the problem with this bill, however well-intentioned it might be, is that it doesn't address definitions of what is intoxicated, what is acutely intoxicated, what is sober, what is an appropriate treatment facility, what sort of supervision is required, what sort of people are hired to staff these facilities, how long can a person be held, and to not address those problems simply invites possibilities of abuse that, whether or not we intend them or foresee them, are nonetheless allowed by the language of the bill that you're considering. Now, there may be hyperbole in my letter, but I don't intend it to be so provocative as to be unreasonable. I'm simply inviting you to consider that this bill, as drafted, does invite
precisely the sorts of abuses that I've extrapolated. And there is nothing in this bill to safeguard the public from abuses should these abuses be practiced. And without those matters being addressed, by putting a supervisory authority in charge of this program, having this program supervised, monitored by, let's say, by the Oregon Health Authority as a detoxification center or a treatment facility would be, you don't have any assurance that the rights and the protections that you're trying to afford our citizens will be maintained. And we can't just take that on faith if we're drafting legislation or considering legislation that could have a very negative impact on basic fundamental constitutional rights. To go on with that, and just to conclude with this, if those abuses take place, this bill also contemplates virtual blanket immunity. And anyone who is the victim of any abuse that could come about because of gaps in this proposed legislation would be left with no remedy. And in fact, as matters now stand, a person who would be in one of these facilities, as the witnesses previous to us said, persons who were brought to these facilities may not be under arrest. Some of them may be. Some of them typically are, in my experience. But in any event, a person brought to a jail at least has the knowledge that ultimately this case will be brought before a judge or a magistrate. And there's no provision in this legislation for that review by the judiciary either. These are some serious gaps that I think render this bill fatally flawed. And I just urge you to reject it or correct it so dramatically that those concerns that I've expressed are addressed. Thank you for your time.
Yeah. Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers. I'm with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. And at this juncture, we have a position of neutrality on the bill. But I did want to raise a number of issues. First of all, I commend the sponsors of the legislation. They're tackling a really important issue. Those of you who know me from my previous job know that I'm passionate about issues related to addictions and mental health, and that services in this area are just woefully underfunded, and the impact of untreated addictions and mental health on public safety is huge. The healthcare industry's inability to tackle these issues is, really in many ways the biggest crisis challenging our communities. The impact on families and kids is just immense. And so low-cost, high-impact techniques make sense in improving the quality of services in economically challenged small towns in Oregon is also critical. So all in all, I urge the committee to find additional ways to improve the quality and quantity of community-based mental health and addiction services. But I also appreciate the chance to come before the committee about another equally important passion, and that's the right to trial by jury, found in the Seventh Amendment of our nation's Constitution. The right to a trial by jury is a cornerstone of democracy. And the idea that someone who's been wrong can make their case to 12 of their peers, and that group of 12 citizens can right an injustice is quite powerful. Now, the legal system's imperfect, but a trial by jury is one place in which the little guy has a fighting chance. And in the general scheme of things, House Bill 2936 chips away at this fundamental constitutional right, ever so slightly. It brings sobering facilities under the immunity granted to treatment facilities. And, I looked at the statutes on page 2 in line 1 and, couldn't, really tell not being a lawyer, just representing them in the Capitol, whether or not the sobering facility would be immune from liability under a variety of circumstances. Looking at the thing, I came up with a handful. If the intoxicated person becomes violent, hurts a volunteer at the sobering facility, is the sobering facility off the hook for that? If the screening and training that was discussed earlier is skimped on when budgets are tight, is there liability there? If the sobering facility is cited for faulty wiring by the building inspector, but again, due to a tight budget, isn't able to take action, the building burns down, killing intoxicated people or volunteers, who's held responsible there? Is there immunity there? if the identities of those who are taken to the sobering facility are released in violation of the statute, harming patients' employment, is there liability there? Is there immunity there? And my point is really that the facts of the individual case matter. Someone who's intoxicated and trips and suffers a concussion might have a weak case. But someone who's intoxicated and abused by a staffer who's repeatedly harmed other intoxicated people might have a stronger case. The facts should matter. I take great pride that in our nation, an individual who has the right to make their case to a jury of their peers, and we as a society should trust juries. So in my opinion, at least 2936 is seeking to tackle a really serious problem. But one thing that I've heard from the proponents is that the cost of liability insurance may be a barrier to sobering facilities getting up and running. And, you know, talking to lobbyists about this, you know, they laugh when I say, you know, it's the, you know, insurance costs. If they're a problem, let's go after them. They just laugh at me and say, they say it's, you know, a lot easier to limit the rights of a 22-year-old who goes out and gets stupid drunk one Saturday night than it is to question insurance company practices. But again, just because this is a very narrow limitation on individual rights, it's still an attack on individual rights, an attack on our Constitution and system of justice. You know, as I said before, we're neutral on the bill. I don't have a brilliant solution here, and I really appreciate the sponsor's openness to improve the legislation. I testified before you today to really raise the importance of immunity as an issue. There's another 8 or 10 bills bouncing around this building on a whole bunch of different committees granting immunity or proposing the grant to immunity to a variety of different good causes. So I'm here to just flag all that stuff for you as opposed to really attacking the intent of the sponsor. So thank you for bearing with me. Thanks for your time.
Quick question. Representative Post. Thank you, Chair Barker. Arthur, I just want to make sure the association is taking a neutral stand, you personally, both?
Both.
Both. Okay. Thank you.
And so I don't plan to move the bill today. I've been in contact with one of the attorneys, one of the members of the committee who's a Harvard lawyer, and he's going to work with the proponents to try to fix what he sees, what he thought was some errors in there, and we will take a look at some of the laws surrounding the detoxification center, the privacy laws. I know in Portland, you wouldn't know if I was in there. I mean, you couldn't call me from the outside. I can't call you from the inside, and so on. But so we'll take a look at all those things, and have Representative Barton is going to work with Representative Stark to try to fix that. I have a soft spot in my heart for Grants Pass. My dad was born there 122 years ago, so
Mr.
my visit
Chair.
Never lived there, but.
I wouldn't mind being a part of that.
Okay, that would be fine.
That discussion. If I could point out two things. First of all, the intention is that this is a place for people who might otherwise be put into jail overnight, where there'd be no real availability.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I think the -4 amendments, as you look at it, make pretty clear that this needs to be linked with a provider organization in a way that has an agreement that OHA worked on. And I'm really, I'm as sensitive to anybody in this room to the issue of individual rights, but we need to find a way to state this in a way that it serves the patient, and I, at that point calling the patient, the patient's best interest, rather than the law enforcement needs. But and we need to find a way for which that person is going to be better off than being dumped in a jail cell, which is certainly not going to be very helpful.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Just one more. Just as I've been listening and reading all the material, one of the things, unless I miss something, this is one of those few times where somebody's not coming to us asking for money or more out of a budget to pay. And this is the kind of programs that I'm excited about when private entities are willing to step in or folks just want to donate their time and their money and whatnot, and I have to, applaud the intentions behind this for that reason.
There have been some serious issues brought up the Constitution.
This is going to ultimately need more money if we're going to try and create these centers where they need to be created.
Well, okay. Anything else? Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you to the members of the
committee. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2936. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2429.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2429 comes to us from the Governor's Office for the Oregon State Police. The bill repeals the January 1, 2016 sunset on the Psychiatric Security Review Board's designation as the Oregon Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Certified Gun Relief Authority. The bill authorizes the Psychiatric Security Review Board to conduct relief hearings for persons found guilty except insanity of a misdemeanor involving violence. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Okay, thank you. Juliet, Juliet Britton and Ms. Okamoto, please.
Thank you, Chairman Baker, Vice Chairs Olson and Williamson. I'm Juliet Britton, Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. House Bill 2429 is a housekeeping bill that would remove the sunset clause for the PSRB's gun relief program and permanently assign firearm restoration authority to our board. Firearm relief responsibilities for those who have an adjudicated mental health determination were transferred from Oregon courts to the PSRB in 2009. Based on the board's expertise in mental health and risk assessment, our already existing relief hearings process, and the statutory mandate that the board's primary concern is the protection of society. The PSRB's relief program is ATF certified, which means that individuals who are granted relief simultaneously receive state firearm restoration as well as their federal firearm privilege. There is no fiscal associated with this bill, and our current service level can accommodate any relief hearings. It's important to note that since 2009, Oregon State Police have been receiving federal grant money to improve the state's process for submission of names to the National Incident Background Check System database. That's also known as NICS. These funds are dependent on having an ATF-certified program in Oregon, and I'd like to note that 28 other states also have ATF-certified programs. Oregon also receives federal grant monies through the Burn Justice Assistance Grant, JAG programs, which also provide for an imposition of penalties for states that do fail to comply with the NICS Improvement Amendment Act. To date, Oregon State Police have uploaded more than 30,500 names of Oregonians who have been determined to be barred under state law from possessing a firearm due to a psychiatric finding by a judge. Additionally, having this relief program complies with the federal funding mandate. Finally, this committee has previously voted to move forward out of committee a guilty except for insanity expungement bill that would, for the first time, allow those adjudicated GEI to have the ability to request expungement after their jurisdiction under our board ends. It should be noted that under federal law, expungement does not automatically restore firearm privileges under federal law. And so this particular program, if it continues, would allow those individuals to also get their federal firearm rights restored. I also want to note that most of the mental health determinations in this state are civil commitments, not guilty except for insanity, and we are the relief authority for all of those determinations. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and the House Judiciary Committee, thank you very much for hearing testimony from me today. I'm Penny Okamoto, the Executive Director of Ceasefire Oregon. From what we understand from HB 2429, it's simply allows a person to apply for relief to the Oregon Psychiatric Security Review Board if he or she cannot possess a weapon because he or she was committed to the Oregon Health Authority, was found to be a person with mental illness under a court order, cannot purchase a weapon for the reasons listed above, or if the person has been found guilty except for insanity of a misdemeanor involving violence. This is a somewhat complicated bill, and I would like to actually thank Counsel Jeff Rhodes for his help on this. From what I understand of the bill, though, however, this bill would not allow people who were convicted of violent felons, person felons, felons that would fall under ORS 133-170, I believe it is, mandatory minimum sentences, to not apply for relief. So CSPY Oregon is concerned that this bill could be used to make unwanted changes to the relief concept as it pertains to violent criminals, including felons. But as we understand this bill currently, without any other changes, CSPY Oregon does support HB 2429.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the panel? Representative
Greenlight. Yes, you taught me that in addition to guilty except for insanity, there's responsible except for insanity. And the amendment on the first page mentions only guilty without insanity. Would it also apply to somebody found responsible except for insanity?
Representative Greenlight.
You're dangerous teaching me things.
Are you asking if responsible except for insanity individuals could request relief?
Well, in the amendment to the bill, you talk specifically about adding persons who are found guilty except for insanity. Line 15 or 16 of the first page. I was wondering if that also applies for a person who's been found responsible except for insanity.
Chairman Barker, Representative Greenlech, and a youth that has been adjudicated responsible except for insanity is not barred under the state law, I think, from firearm under current law. So therefore, they're not needing relief under our program. My understanding is that there might be a separate process for the juvenile records. So anyone found responsible except for sanity is a youth. And so how those records are handled and uploaded is it's a different statute.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Appreciate
your testimony. We'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2429.
2347. No, that was 2429.
We just did 2429, didn't we?
That's our
we're doing
a
work session.
Oh, yeah, we're moving.
It's not ready to move.
It's not ready to move. Yeah, close the work session. It's not ready to move. Sorry. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2347.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2347 comes to us from the House Interim Committee on Judiciary. The bill extends the suspension of driving privileges beyond the end of the statutorily prescribed suspension or revocation if the person fails to submit proof of the installation or continuing presence of a required ignition interlock device. It also restructures the laws relating to the ignition interlock devices without making major substantive changes. We don't have the paperwork on this bill today.
Okay. Christy Finney Dunn, Connie Cabrera, and Amy Joyce. In any order, just identify yourself for the record.
Honorable Chair and members of the committee, my name is Christy Finney Dunn. I actually live in Vancouver, Washington. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to testify in front of you for this bill. My 28-year-old son, Dustin Finney, was killed in Portland on August 12th of 2011. He was killed by a hit-and-run drunk driver. My son was a college student who was just beginning to live the life that he had made plans for. He never got the chance to get married, have children, or graduate, and work in the field of his choosing. The young man who killed him was convicted of criminally negligent homicide, felony hit-and-run, vehicular assault of a bicyclist because he hit two bicyclists at the same time, and DUII. He also lost his driver's license for life. During the sentencing phase, he most objected to the fact that he would lose his driver's license for life because he and his family told the judge that that was not fair. It was his first DUI. Sorry, I'm very nervous. Because of this young man's conviction, he will have difficulty finding work and possibly housing and various other things in his life once he's out of prison. And his son, who was born after he went to prison, has never seen him outside of a prison setting. Since my son's death, I started speaking at victim impact panels both in Washington and in Oregon. And in the audience, people come up to you afterward. And since I've been doing this, some of the people who have approached me afterward have been the first person who was on the scene after my son was killed. He was there for DUI. I've met the medical examiner assistant who put my son into the van from at the crime scene, and he was there for a DUI. I've met several of Dustin's friends at these victim impact panels who were there for DUI, knowing that their friend Dustin had been killed by someone else driving under the influence. On the first anniversary of my son's death, my own brother, driving to a memorial hike we were having in Dustin's honor, got a DUI. Since then, my nephew has gotten a DUI. So I am here to say that I support more accountability for DUI drivers from the very beginning. The young man who killed my son, it's true, this was his first DUI. But I do know that he had had run-ins with impairment prior to that. This was actually his second hit and run, but it was his first DUI. I feel that the consequences to these drivers must be very personal to them because they don't seem to be learning anything from the really drastic consequences to other people, even people who are very important to them. It seems to me that they must have some kind of hands-on personal experience, something that's detrimental to them or a learning experience specifically for them to hopefully help them understand that things need to change and that they need to be responsible. So please pass Bill 2344-47 to demonstrate the seriousness of the crime of DUI, and I hope that together we can save lives and the quality of lives, not just for innocent victims, but also for the people who are driving impaired as well and their families. Thank you very much.
Dear Chairman Barker and members of the committee, my name is Connie Cabrera, and I'm here today offering testimony on HB 2347 on behalf of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. In addition to being a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, I am also speaking as a DUI victim and an offender. On June 21st, 1998, my daughter, Sonia Samoilov, was killed by a drunk driver. I've been convicted of two DUIs, and I have personal firsthand knowledge of the ignition interlock device that is the focus of HB 2347 and several other bills in the legislative process this session. I'm sorry, I'm nervous also. I am also a volunteer speaker for Marion and Clackamas County Victims Impact Panels. And as Christy testified, they're very powerful. And when people are come into the meetings with an attitude and don't want to be there, but when they leave with tears in their eyes and they tell you how very sorry they are and that they'll never drink and drive, you can only hope that they're sincere about it. And if just one person changes their attitude and doesn't drive after drinking, then I've served my purpose. The ignition interlock device system in Oregon has been developed over the years with the very best of intentions, but with very little thought given to coordination and oversight. HB 2347 before you today closes a very glaring loophole in this system, a loophole that allows a DUI offender to simply wait out their suspension and their requirement for an IID by not renewing their license. And while it may be the offender's prerogative to not renew their driving privileges when they choose to, it should be done with the oversight and monitoring of an IID for the period of time initially required by the courts. And I do personally have a friend that took advantage of this loophole and did just that exact same thing. The interlock is not, despite complaints, a tool designed to punish an offender. It is designed to support treatment and to help offenders break the grip of substance abuse while reteaching safe, responsible driving habits every day. The interlock also gives a strong measure of public safety during that time period when an offender may struggle most with breaking the cycles of addiction. Data shows that 9 out of 10 drivers arrested for DUI in Oregon has a significant substance abuse issue that requires professional treatment. As an offender, I personally had an interlock on my car, which I absolutely detested. I hated it, and blowing into it to start my car was not only convenient, it was very embarrassing and humiliating. I used to pull into parking lots and just slide down in my seat so people couldn't see me having to blow on the machine to start my car. But I can say without a doubt that the IID was most responsible for helping me regain sobriety and recommit to safe and responsible driving. Even though I didn't care for the interlock, it was the most effective and impacting condition of my treatment. The interlock supports an offender as they work to overcome substance abuse and also provides an immediate measure of public safety every time an offender gets behind the wheel and confronts that decision to drive impaired or to drive sober. On behalf of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, on behalf of DUII victims, on behalf of my daughter Sonia and myself, and others struggling with addiction and recovery, I respectfully request that the House Judiciary Committee pass HB 2347 with full support and recommendation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Amy? Chair Barker and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, representing both the DMV and our Transportation Safety Division. Council and the other witnesses have well described what the bill does. I'm here to answer any technical questions you may have, and also to note that in your Senate counterpart committee, Senator Przanski is convening several people to work on the 5 or so ignition interlock bills that are in his committee. I and several others are participating in that, so just to inform you that there's work going on the Senate side on this entire issue of interlocks.
I have a question.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Amy, are there any conversations going on about standards for interlock devices? Because I know in Oregon we have much lower, if we have any, standards about the actual device than in other states, and I've been told that this is considered a dumping ground state, and so we're requiring people to put machines in their cars, which is great, but if they don't work, then it doesn't serve the purpose. And I just wanted to know if you knew of any standards being discussed anywhere in the building.
Chair Barker and Vice Chair Williamson, DMV actually has the authority under the statute to write rules around the device itself. And after a few sessions where nothing sort of happened with that, and you're accurate, Oregon was considered a dumping ground for older devices. So after the 13 session, DMV did begin a rulemaking process, convened a significant stakeholder group, and updated the standards, and as of January 1 of 14, I believe, those standards went into place. I believe it was January 1 of 15. Most noticeably, going to the standard of what's called a fuel cell technology, which is pretty much the standard around the country, so really upgraded the required device. Probably about half of the authorized dealers in Oregon fell off the list. Coming in June 1 is an additional requirement that a camera be installed as part of the device as a method to combat fraud, you know, so that other people aren't blowing into the device, or if somebody has a positive alcohol reading on the device and they're taken to court, it dissuades them from saying, well, that was somebody else who did that blow, it wasn't me. So that's coming online June 1.
Great, thank you. I'm glad that the DMV did work on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony. We really appreciate you coming before us today. Neil Meyer and I think Brad Frederick, if I'm reading that right.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We're really not weighing in on the bill as so much as using this as a launch pad to bring to your attention a conversation we hope to have during the interim. It's very clear that suspension periods and ignition interlocks are integrally related. But Oregon, it does something that perhaps does not optimize public safety. Oregon relies on really hard suspension periods where you cannot drive for a very lengthy period of time. And then at the tail end of it, what this bill is saying is if you want to get your license back, you have to put on the ignition interlock device. What some states are doing, so for instance, Washington, they're saying, okay, we're going to suspend your license. We're going to revoke your license. But we're going to give you a provisional license early. It's an ignition interlock device license. And the reason they do that is because there's two advantages to that. Number one, what people have found is if you give a hard suspension period of a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, life, people do drive. They do. They drive. They might drive to the bar, but they're driving to Safeway and they're taking their kid to the dentist. They drive. They're driving uninsured. They can't get insurance. They're suspended. So what they do up in Washington is they give them this ignition interlock device license. We will let you drive with an ignition interlock device, and you have to show proof of insurance. Now, the reason that's a long conversation is because Washington has really in-depth an expanded supervision of those ignition interlock device licenses. But the advantage is that the ignition interlock device will rat out your very dangerous driver. It is the drivers who, within the first 6 to 8 months, are going to have your bad blows, your tamperings, and your deinstalls. Those are the people you need to worry about. The people who go with no negative reports for a good 10, 12 months, those are not your problem drivers. So there are some states, like Washington, then, that switches this around. Instead of relying on very hard suspension periods where we know people drive uninsured, they give them the ignition interlock device license up sooner. And that does promote public safety. So there has been, Oregon has had the benefit of a very sophisticated national company organization that came in and did an audit of our system. They recommended against relying on hard suspension periods. They recommended considering provisional licenses with ignition interlock devices. We hope to generate that kind of a discussion during the interim. So thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Brad Frelick. I am Director of Government Relations for Consumer Safety Technology in Toxilock, and I am one of the four companies that is in the Coalition of Ignition Interlock Manufacturers, which accounts for about 85% of the market here in the state of Oregon. First off, let me just talk about what I would consider to be a technical amendment to this bill. We certainly support what this bill is looking at doing as far as getting rid of that ability to just sit out the interlock requirement. But we think there needs to be an amendment to this bill because while it does say that the interlock must be installed during that period, otherwise the suspension would, in essence, take effect again. It does not speak to the ignition interlock installation period. So the way we read this, you could sit out until the last 2 days of this period that they talk about here, go get the interlock for those last 2 days, and then when your suspension period is done, you've met this standard, but you've only had the interlock for 2 days. We think that's not the intent of this bill. We think that needs to be corrected. In other states, what they do to correct that is a simpler approach. What they do is they simply say, for this level of offense, whether it's first, second, third, or whether it's tiered by BAC levels, there is an ignition interlock period of this long. You may get this under a hardship permit or restricted driving permit or whatever you want, or you may get it as a condition of reinstatement. But the bottom line is you will never be eligible for full reinstatement until you have served your interlock period. States that have done this have ended these little game, cat and mouse games that the offenders play trying to take their chances and go that period of time without doing it. They say, basically what they say is, well, I can't avoid it. I might as well do it now. And they come in earlier. And to the previous speaker's point, we certainly agree with what she said as far as the hard suspension periods. All the data shows that all those hard suspension periods do are teach these people how to drive illegally. Some of them are a little bit more careful, but the longer they go without getting caught, the less likely they are to come into the program. So we would certainly agree that that's the way to go. The federal government used to have a stance that you must have, for at least repeat offenders, you must have a one-year hard time period. In 2008, they softened that and they said, okay, you can go 45 days hard as long as the rest of the year is on the interlock. And then 2 years ago, they completely removed that and said, okay, if you're not going to give them the 1 year hard, you can just give them 1 year of interlock. Because they've recognized that the most liberal studies out there say over half of those people continue to drive. If you are in rural areas, the numbers go up much, much higher than that. So they are driving anyway. It's not working as a deterrent to driving. What license suspension can do is can have a preventative effect. In other words, it can cause persons to take the responsible choice and call a cab, designate a driver before the fact. But once it's already happened, suspension does not prevent them from driving. The better course is to get them on the interlock as soon as possible. In fact, in the state of Washington, for repeat offenders, it states that you have 5 days from the time of arrest to get that device on. Because as much as this may fly in the face of what you might think, statistics show that the most likely time that a person is going to get another DUI after their first is immediately after that first. And I know that's counterintuitive. Most people think, well, no, they would learn their lesson, then they would lose the effects of that, and they would get it later. No, that is not the case. These devices work, and as the previous speaker said, for those people who it was just truly a mistake, it will weed them out. This is a wonderful tool for figuring out who's who among that. Those who truly have a problem and a severe problem, they will be the ones who are getting the violations. There's another bill out there in this current session that would create compliance-based monitoring. In other words, you would have to successfully complete the time on your interlock before you are eligible to get off. So in other words, if you have numerous violations, you would be extended. That is exactly what needs to be done. For a public safety fail-safe, those people need to stay on that device until they can prove that they are safe to be on the roads again. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will not move the bill today. We'll take a look at some of your really good suggestions there to, for amendments. Also, we'll try to coordinate with Senator Prozanski to be sure we're not.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2347. Open a work session on House Bill 2357.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2357 comes to us from the House Interim Committee on Judiciary. This bill modifies certain law enforcement defenses for firearms crimes to allow for off-duty and honorably retired police officers to avail themselves of the same defenses as those individuals with concealed carry permits. The Dash 2 amendments before the committee today represent a combination of House Bill 2357 with House Bill 2348, which allow the defenses to apply both to off-duty and honorably retired police officers. The bill with the Dash 2 amendments is ready to move today.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2357, I move the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2357.
Representative Williams moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2357. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2357 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2357 2357 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation. Are there any, is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. I'll carry the bill. Open a work session on House Bill 2628.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2628 comes to us at the request of Representative Leininger and Senator Gelser. The bill disallows all filing fees, service fees, and hearing fees in an action for a court's stalking protective order, even if additional relief is sought. The bill provides that a court may include protections for a petitioner's children and animals in a stalking protective order. We do have Dash 1 amendments before the committee today. The Dash 1 amendments remove the provisions allowing for a court to include those additional protections and leave only intact the piece regarding the filing fees. And the bill, as amended, is ready to move today.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 20, the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2628.
Representative Williams moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2628. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2628 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2628 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Krieger.
I had originally marked down no on the bill. I'm trying to figure out what was the
there, probably took out what you we were took out vote the no on.
There was there was concern expressed about that firearms might have been removed without due process. So the proponents of the bill removed that section of the bill, so there would be no question that that's not in.
Okay.
Are there any objections? We're moving the
bill.
Are there any objections? Hearing that's ordered. Representative Leininger, would you carry the bill, please? Open a work session on House Bill 2424.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2424 comes to us at the request of the Governor's Office for the Department of Corrections. The bill allows an authorized staff member of the Department of Corrections, State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, and Oregon Corrections Enterprises assigned to work in a department building to store a personal handgun and ammunition in a vehicle if certain conditions are met. The bill provides that the department does not have the duty to inspect or secure the vehicles or parking areas or determine staff compliance with the law. It directs the department to adopt written policies or rules to regulate possession and storage of a personal handgun and ammunition. The Dash 3 amendments before the committee specify that this bill applies to any motor vehicle, including a motorcycle and a soft top vehicle, such as a convertible or a Jeep, and the bill is ready to move with the Dash 3 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2424.
Representative Williamson moves the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2424. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2424 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2424 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Krieger, would you carry that bill for us? Is there any further business to come before the committee? The committee is adjourned. Thank you, committee. Thank you, committee. The committee is adjourned.